This is Bill Teeple, and this is Icon Art Radio, broadcasting from the Cultural District on the Square in Fairfield, Iowa. And I'm here with Donna Colby and Alan Cobb. And what's our topic? Where are we going today, Donna?
Well, I was just reading a book the other day by Thomas More. He's the one who became famous for writing the book Care of the Soul, and he's written several other books along those lines. And he made a statement about art that I really liked in this one book. He said, "It is the nature of art to have an empty center. It has this in common with religion, its inherent emptiness. And for that reason, art is essential to the spiritual life." And what he meant, of course, by emptiness is not nothingness. He meant it in the Buddhist sense of kind of unprejudiced fullness. And so anyway, I thought that was a good definition of art that we could jump off from.
That. Yeah. That's very nice. And I have often referred to the arts as we participate in them as a kind of spiritual calling, and I think of it as one of the religions, if we want to use the term religion, we'd have to start defining that, of our age, because at its center is this nameless what of it all. And I think that's what religion is all about at its core, what it's trying to explain, and we're trying to do performances to get at through the religious activities. And I think that's what we're doing with art. So it's been a bit of a cause on my part to try to get people to get it, get what art is essentially all about. So it's a great quote. Thank you for bringing that
Thank
in
Thomas
today.
More. Yeah. Well, and it also made me realize, too, that if you're doing art every day, you may start out at the beginning of your, you know, for me, when I was a little girl and I was doing art, I started out drawing things, little stories from my imagination, but they were about moms and dads and children and houses and, you know, all the things I was familiar with. And then you go to school, and everybody's drawing houses and trees and flowers. And again, just a little bit of an expanded world of those same things. And then you go on to high school, college, and you often start out, at least you used to, maybe it's completely different now. And even when I went in the 60s, it was starting to be different. But in high school anyway, there were still lifes, you know, they'd set up bowl of fruit and you drew that, or an old pair of shoes and you would draw that, and there would be assignments where we would go out in nature and draw the bark of a tree close up or something like that. So you're relating to the world and doing art and producing a work of creativity that's not the actual thing you're drawing, but is your own inner takeoff on that and describes your relationship to those things. But after some time, if you keep doing art over and over and over again and become an adult and you're still working in your studio, eventually you start to go back into that inner empty center without even realizing it, without even necessarily intending to go there. You can't help it, because to get to a deeper creative impulse, that's the only direction you can go. And I think a lot of artists are astonished when that begins to happen, especially if they haven't really been involved in some kind of spiritual path in or religion, and they find these things happening inside. It's mind-boggling, and you know, and they get high from it, of course. And some artists know what to do with that, and some artists don't. But I think it has to be the direction that an artist naturally goes in, if they're working every day.
Well, I think the practice, just putting the attention and the mind-body activity to this practice leads here, is what you're saying. And I see this as a teacher, because it is like you described, that people come in and they're attracted to this idea of learning how to draw. And they don't quite know why they're attracted to learning how to draw and paint, but it's an attractive thing. They've already gotten a clue to the magic of it. It's like learning magician. It's a kind of a magician's trick. And if you can do it, all your friends say, "Wow, you know, you do that really good. You know, you created the illusion of that thing. And how did you do that?" You know, so it's attractive. But you put yourself to this practice, and it usually starts with drawing and painting. It doesn't have to. And in this day and age, with all the media and all the abstract art we've been immersed in for over a century, it's a little bit more complicated. But it's still either adjusting, you know, working with colors and forms, or it's looking at things outside yourself and trying to reproduce them. So there's a sort of surface level of entry. But as you practice, it's like the rosary beads, you know, or some kind of a meditation practice that draws your attention. It starts with a surface level of activity or a surface level experience, and then the attention is drawn deeper and deeper and deeper. And so just the continued practice over time leads the artist to what I always say is the maturing of the artist. And sometimes it takes 10 or 20 years, and there's a sudden developmental change that you perceive. The guy has come into the silence and the aloneness of the practice. And I think he's beginning now to sit and to work in that place that is it's the silent center of the thing more. Whether he kind of understands it or not intellectually,
yeah,
starts to happen. And that's where the art now begins to bubble up. In other words, that silent of it all, that sits,
the empty center,
yeah, now begins to actually be lively on the surface. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see in the art, that is the magic in there. And it's a mysterious and magical and miraculous thing that the artist does in empowering a physical thing with spirit.
Mm. Well, and it's interesting because he, another like couple paragraphs from that quote, Thomas More said, he was talking about the importance of images, both in poetry and in visual art. And he said, images foster wonder rather than conclusions and make for people of wisdom rather than opinion. And I like that quote as well as just a little bit more delineation of the art from the empty center, because I know in my own case and other people I know who started out as prose writers, I always was an artist, but then I worked as a writer, and I put my attention on words and very clear words and nonfiction writing, and gradually shifted to fiction writing. And I know of other people who have done that and then had to, at a certain point, begin writing poetry because they couldn't say all that they wanted to say from that deep place in prose. And for me, I skipped the poetry and jumped straight from writing fiction to going back to visual art and painting again, but for the same reason. I found that the writing was becoming frustrating to me because I wanted to say subtler things than I could say in these sentences and paragraphs in my prose writing.
Are you able to talk? Our dear Alan is recovering from a cold. Because I think you could jump in here.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking of which thing to jump in with for so many. I mean, I have tended to write. When I started writing as a kid, I wrote almost entirely fiction. And then gradually, I began writing more and more nonfiction because school demanded it. You know, they wanted essays and book reports and things like that. And I didn't enjoy that writing, but I was good enough at it. And then eventually, you know, I found myself much further along in life and hadn't really thought about how much fiction I was writing. And I realized I hadn't written any in a long, long, long time. And everything was was nonfiction. And in fact, everything was striving toward, the stuff that I enjoyed writing was essays that were trying to get at something extremely subtle. And I think I may have come to the conclusion that the subtler the point you're trying to make, the more words it will require to make it if you're doing it in prose, which again is what motivates me to occasionally just leap out of that area and in language and do poetry. Although more often I'd leap out of it and go into nonverbal arts, and sometimes it's visual art, but usually it's sound. And I guess one of the things that's always intrigued me about sound is the distinction between speech and sound. Words and the sounds of words are very different things. This came out in that seminar I did a long time ago on sound. There's a part of the brain that detects whether the sound coming in might be speech. And because the speech center, I suspect this is the reason, because the speech center marshals so much energy and so much of the nervous system to do its analysis and interpretation and comprehension, the brain isn't really inclined to turn on the speech machine unless it needs it. So in the normal state of walking down the street, the speech system is off. And when you hear a sound, it goes to this speech detector, which is just a little system that says, that's not speech, and the speech machine stays off. And if it passes some threshold where the speech detector says, I think that is speech, then the whole big speech system turns on, and I sort of imagine this turn of the century, industrial revolution machine sort of chuffing and puffing and sweating and clanking and big doors closing and fires burning hotter and steam rising, and it finally starts, you are now engaged on the level of language. And what's interesting is one of the things I was able to dig up for the seminar was a sound which, when you hear it, is sufficiently non-speech so that your speech detector concludes it's not speech. And there's no question, everybody in the audience recognizes, that's just gobbledygook, doesn't have anything, doesn't sound like speech. Then you tell the audience what that sound is saying. And it turns out that in an astonishingly distorted way, it is in fact tracking a sentence in English. And now that they know it's speech, they hear it as speech, and they can no longer hear it as non-speech. You have no choice. The speech detector has been trained now, and it turns the speech thing on every time you hear that sound. And I've noticed in my own life that when speech and meaning and language is engaged, that there's even a physical sensation. I almost feel it in my brain. I mean, I know you're not supposed to be able to feel things in your brain, so it's probably not what I'm feeling, but I can tell when I let go of speech. There's something inside in the top part of my head that seems to kind of relax like a muscle. And if I go for a long time without using that and then suddenly become engaged in speech, I can feel it tense up. And I've come up with a theory which I want to throw at you very quickly here, and that is that the sensation I'm experiencing is, and the physiologists can all contact me by email about this, but I think I'm experiencing something like the corpus callosum, which is what mediates the intercommunication between the two hemispheres. And if we assume the simplistic model that the speech centers are pretty much on the left side of the brain and the affective centers are pretty much on the right, and a balanced view of things would require the corpus callosum to sort of keep both sides in good balance. When you start getting into verbal focus, the corpus callosum sensation, which I'll call it, I think is an inhibitory function that's going on, which is enabling the left side of the brain to dominate more than usual. the speech centers are given a much higher priority now over everything. Because, you know, from a survival standpoint, once you are in the speech domain, what people are saying can be a matter of life and death. So it's comparable to recognizing the roar of a lion behind you. And I think this accounts for why, once you get into the analytical style of thinking and the highly verbal style of communicating, that very gradually, your affect is turned off. The attention ends up swallowed up in this domain, and everything is in terms of the words and the meanings and the definitions of terms and stuff like that. And you almost have no emotions left at all. You can appreciate or not appreciate, sort of on the sense of trueness or correctness, but that's about it. And I think that's why people get into so much trouble when they get to thinking too much, because in throwing themselves farther and farther into a commitment to the verbal side of the brain, they're also, by, you know, physiological mandate, shutting down the you know, intuitive and affective feeling side of the brain. So you become kind of, you know, an intellectual robot the more you focus on the details of the words that you're saying. And I think, of course, writing prose, fiction or nonfiction, leads in that direction. And it's always, you know, a delicate balance to remember how the characters feel while you're trying to convey the room that they're in or the situation.
I got to say this quick. Okay. So but the other side of the brain is nonlinear.
Right.
And so it holds, it can grasp the whole in a symbol or a seed or a shape or a form or a poem.
Right. Right.
That's a combination of the senses. It holds all of that. And so this other side could go on for ad infinitum, trying to explain it in a linear fashion to get there and never get there.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's really what made me think of that. But go on, you had another.
Well, and also I was thinking about the artist in the studio who is not engaged in, his speech center is not engaged. And what you were saying earlier is that the speech center uses up more energy. So when an artist is focused on or dealing with pure images and not the speech center, the artist is conserving energy. And that's probably why when an artist is really deeply engaged, you actually feel more energetic when you finish working in your studio than you did before.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. When I'm doing well with non-analytical stuff, I feel energized when I'm done. When I'm doing well with analytical work, I may feel a tremendous sense of accomplishment when I'm done, but I'm also wasted and it's time to like watch television or, you know, go lean against a tree somewhere.
I've also noticed when we watch these films on video night of the great artists and they're describing their work, many of them are, it seems almost difficult for them to use very many words. And they'll come out with these little sentences that are like pearls of wisdom, but they're very sparse. And it's probably because of this whole thing you were describing that they're spending their time in this other realm. And
well, one of the things that surprised me when I was putting together my poetry collection was that a couple of the poems that I wanted to save that had survived a lot of cullings over the years, I really, to be perfectly honest, had to say had no intended meaning. They were strings of words that I found very relevant in some strange way, but they were relevant the way colors are relevant. They weren't relevant as statements, yet they were words, so they, you know, invoked a whole string of very explicit meanings, and that sequence of meanings ought to have a syntax. It ought to be saying something. But I concluded that these poems were abstract. They were like abstract paintings. They were not trying to say something. They were trying to express something, but they weren't trying to make a statement of any kind whatsoever.
Yeah, Gertrude Stein wrote that way, and she called herself the first cubist writer.
Yes,
because she said she said that's why she was the only one who truly understood what Picasso was doing, because she was doing the same thing with words.
Yes. Yeah, I love that expression. I guess I'd rather be more of an abstract impressionist writer.
I've always found it totally fascinating when we play these videos, that, as you mentioned, how like simple the artists are about their work. You know, you read the art magazines and the criticism and all of this explanation with people using their fancy intellects and their PhDs in philosophy and the format of the international art magazines to go on and on and on explaining the period, you know, the context and the period and its relationship to all of this scholarly study and linguistics and blah blah blah, on and on and on, and this place of this guy's work in that context. Then you hear the guy talk about the work, and it's like, it's a huge relief for me, but also it's so consistent. When you see this, it's so consistent. There's those guys, which are the whole left-hand side of the brain, and there's the artist in his studio. And if he hasn't started to like go off on some left-brain trip himself, feeling obligated to do that, when he's talking about exactly what's going on in the studio, it's usually the simplest kind of like hard to explain, and I just felt like doing this. And
I was just trying to get it a different shade of yellow without it going
to
pumpkin.
No, it's that simple. And from the outside, if you've been reading all these magazines and stuff, you sort of think like,
there should be
there's got to be more to it than that, because you know, it's selling for $1 million, and
you can't just be dribbling paint intuitively.
Because he likes it, and he thinks that's fun.
And that circles back to the first quote about it's the nature of art to have an empty center, because there is a lot more to it. The more to it than that is something you can't describe in words. And so in fact, many of the artists will say this. They will say, Matisse said this, he said you should cut off your tongue, because an artist should cut off his tongue, because the paintings say what you want to say. And if someone gives you an interview and asks you to tell them what you're trying to do, you won't be honest. You can't be as honest as your paintings are, because that's your expression.
Yeah, and if you feel like your painting isn't doing it, then you need to go back in the studio and keep working until you feel it's in there.
Yeah, I usually can explain why I like something that I did, but I can't explain the thing. You know, I can say this white panel with little speakers on each side is intriguing to me, because when you stand on one side of it, you hear both sides, and you hear each side in a different dimensional way. And when you switch to the other side of the panel, you hear the same both sides, and the only difference is the dimensional difference. Okay, fine, that's a nice theoretical reason for doing it. And I knew in the back of my mind that that would be one of the effects of having it. But that wasn't why I wanted to do it. And the reason I wanted to do it, I mean, I remember when we were having lunch and I decided, you know, well, that's what I would do. So we sort of thought we should go ahead and do it. And it was just, it just seemed like what I saw in the gallery was this white slab floating in space with two tiny speakers on each side. And it came out all done. It wasn't something I thought, well, let's see if the speakers were bigger or if they were closer together. Or I just knew exactly how it had to be right from the very first thought. And then fortunately it was simple enough so that when I made it, it came out exactly that way. But with poetry, I mean, if someone says, why did you write that? You know, I wrote it so that it would be there. I didn't write it to prove some theory about something. And when they say, what are you trying to say? All I can say is those words, the poem, that's what I was trying to say. It wasn't like I had an idea and I thought, if I distort the idea and wrap it in unusual terminology and screw around with the punctuation and spacing and spread it out on short little lines, that that will somehow make it a poem. It's got nothing to do with that. And I'm always fascinated when people ask, you know, what does that mean of visual art? Because unless it's a political cartoon or something, there isn't much that it can mean that is better expressed any way other than in a painting like that one. You know, why would you make a painting if you're trying to write an essay? You should just say what you mean. And I think that's what people forget, is that painters are saying what they mean in paint. And you have to learn how to read paint in order to hear their message.
Yeah, and the people who spend most of their time, like you were saying, in the left brain, verbal, logical area, and feel comfortable in that area, don't feel so comfortable with this empty center that we've been talking about, even to the degree of when they're alone, they always have the radio on or the television on or something like that, that keeps that speech center alive.
Well, actually, it's not so much that the empty center is what you eventually are going to find deep within the art. It's that the empty center has to become the playing field for us, for the viewer actually to get it, or to not be stuck somewhere.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, one can only have fond hopes that the people who have to have the radio on all the time eventually will come to be more comfortable with silence.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.